This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, Wither Iraq and Syria. We examine the post-election climate in Baghdad as a recount of ballots from the fraud-tainted May elections ensues and provide an update on the political situation in war-torn Syria. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Amid allegations of fraud, Iraq's parliament is carrying out a manual recount of votes cast in May's legislative elections, delaying the formation of a new government. Further adding to the government's woes, widespread protests have erupted in the mostly Shiite provinces of the south over Baghdad's failure to provide basic services such as electricity, health care, and clean water. Iraq is facing the worst electricity blackouts in years. In addition, the nation is still picking up the pieces after the militant group Islamic State destroyed a swath of Iraq's electrical and oil refining capacity. Despite Baghdad's recent territorial victory over IS, the group continues to wreak havoc by launching sporadic attacks. In Syria, despite claims by President Bashar al-Assad that the seven-year war is heading toward its conclusion, that may not be the case. A series of attacks last week by the so-called Islamic State in southwest Syria killed and injured scores, a show of deadly force in an area where the government is pressing an offensive against an affiliate of the extremist group. Nonetheless, Syrian government forces backed by Russia and Iran have been sweeping through a swath of territory along Syria's southern border with Jordan, seizing areas that have long been held by Western-backed rebels seeking to oust President al-Assad. The United States has openly told opposition groups in the south not to expect U.S. support as part of a larger disengagement from Syria. In recent days, Israel helped facilitate the evacuation of hundreds of rescue workers known as the White Helmets and their families from an embattled pocket of southern Syria, helping them travel through Israeli-held territory to reach Jordan. Despite sporadic attacks from IS in Syria, there is a trend line toward military victory for Assad and his internal and external supporters, with an uncertain future after that. Nonetheless, regional observers say that as long as Bashar al-Assad remains in power, backed by Iranian militias and Moscow, there will be no lasting peace or stability for that war-torn country. More than half of Syria's population of 22 million has been displaced, 6.5 million inside Syria, and over 6 million abroad. Most are Sunnis. The Economist magazine says that the once vibrant multicultural religious mosaic that was the hallmark of Syria is giving way to sectarianism and domination by minority Christian and Alawite groups. They are suspicious of Sunni Muslims, many of whom oppose the barbaric rule of Bashar al-Assad since the beginning of the peaceful uprising in March 2011 in the city of Daraa. Well, joining us to discuss the state of play in Syria and Iraq are Jennifer Caffarella. She's Director of Intelligence Planning at the Institute for the Study of War. That's a policy group based in Washington. Ms. Caffarella formerly served as a Syria analyst at ISW. And Ellen Lapson. She is Professor and Director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, and that's a college based in the nearby state of Virginia. Previously, Ellen Lapson served as CEO of the Stimson Center, a nonpartisan policy group and research center based here in Washington. And we had the privilege of interviewing Ellen Lapson in May about the Greater Middle East. Now, both ladies join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Carol. Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Jennifer Caffarella, let me begin with you briefly. Let's start with Iraq. Can you give us a sense of the state of play amid these contested parliamentary elections, the vote recount?
Sure. The state of play in Iraq is increasingly unstable given the scale of the protest movement. Now, the Iraqi Prime Minister, Haider al-Abadi, who is U.S. friendly, has been taking a lot of necessary and productive steps towards addressing the demands of the protesters and attempting to ensure that the protests do not become violent and that likewise violence is not used against the protest movement. We meanwhile have a very contentious political competition ongoing in Baghdad over the formation of the next government after the recent Iraqi election led to a victory by Muqtada al-Sadr, a nationalist Shia cleric who won the most seats but needs to actually bargain with other key stakeholders in order to form a government. And what we have is a pretty concerted effort by Iran's proxies in that government formation effort to ensure that they hold a significant power base and control of ministries in the next government.
Turning to you, Ellen Lapson, to add or subtract to what Jennifer said, when you were last here in May, there was a certain amount of optimism right before the elections, and now this recount amid allegations of fraud, protests across the country, political competition between Iranian-backed Shiite parties and the others. Your take.
So I'm not significantly more pessimistic than I was in May, and I didn't mean to convey that everything was perfect in Iraq. I think Iraq is a democratizing country, and it's very messy, and there are a lot of bumps in the road. The process of government formation since the American invasion in 2003 has always taken a good number of months, and there's a lot of bargaining and horse trading. We can deduce this time that I think some of the bargaining is, you know, happening in the smoke-filled corridors behind the scenes. It's not all completely transparent. And like in the past, there's this fascinating back and forth between Iran's ability to influence and shape the decisions that are made or the U.S.'s ability to shape and influence. And we see that Muqtada al-Sadr, he is the kingmaker. He does not want to be prime minister himself, but he is, as the party that came in with the largest share, he has enormous influence right now, and he seems to be alternating between thinking about a coalition that would be led by a pro-Iranian group, Mr. Ameri, or by Haider al-Abadi, the incumbent prime minister. But I want to just draw a little more attention to the problems in the south and the problems in the north. So in the south, it's unbearably hot. There are water shortages. There are, you know, basic economic stress that brings people out to say our government is not delivering on the services that it should. I don't think we know yet whether this will blossom into something that is a nationwide, you know, calling into question the legitimacy of the government. I think that is not necessarily the most likely scenario. But in the north, we also have separate problem of allegations of fraud, and that the distribution of votes among the sort of establishment Kurdish parties and the more reform-oriented Kurdish parties is now in dispute, and some people are quite disheartened that more of a democratic culture in the Kurdish region has not yet been established. So I think the country has, and as you mentioned, I think that the remnants of ISIS or the return of ISIS in a, you know, less territorial based strategy is worrisome, but I don't think the current dynamics, as dramatic and perhaps disturbing as they may be, necessarily represent a dangerous turning point for Iraq.
Back to you, Jennifer, to talk about the contested elections once again and the competition between Iran-backed groups and perhaps the more nationalist groups among the Shiites. This recount, are you optimistic that once it is finished, there will be credibility in the outcome? I mean, how do you see this playing out?
Sure. I do certainly hope that the recount process will result in an outcome that is perceived as legitimate and that is objectively legitimate and not subject once again to fraud or allegations of fraud that sow distrust in the government. I think my concern more broadly is that the U.S. is not investing quite actively enough in shaping this government formation process or in supporting the establishment of political conditions in Iraq more broadly that are conducive to American interests, but also that help prevent the ISIS ability to resurge. ISIS, of course, exploits political grievances and will benefit from the formation, if it occurs, of a pro-Iranian government in Baghdad.
I'd like you to comment on that also, Ellen, because, you know, the United States is so concerned about Iranian influence. We're witnessing the pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal. The United States wants to combat Iran at every turn. So how do you assess the U.S. influence in Iraq vis-a-vis this problem? Are they not active enough? Do they see the threat? And what about ISIS as well? What is the role?
So I think that the embassy on the ground, I'm sure, is extremely active right now. We also have Brett McGurk as the ranking American in the coalition against ISIS. But I do agree that at the higher levels, in the past, we've usually seen somebody who has the Iraq file in the White House. When it was George W. Bush, it was him. the president. He liked to talk to his Iraqi counterparts on a very frequent basis. And the Iraqis sort of got used to that level of attention, and much less in the Obama administration, although Joe Biden was often the interlocutor on Iraq. So they were getting higher level attention than they're getting right now. It's clear that President Trump has the more detached view, which is, isn't this war supposed to be over? If we accomplished our mission vis-a-vis ISIS, can't we come home? And that terrifies, I think, the Iraqis who are pro-American, that the United States would just so profoundly lose interest. We still have a huge American embassy there. The U.S. military cares deeply about stability in Iraq. But you may have a policy decision to disengage even more than we are now. So I do agree that usually in these moments when the Iraqis take several months to form their government, one would want to see higher level attention.
Before we turn to Syria after the break, Jennifer, anything else that worries you with regard to Iraq's trajectory at this point?
Yes, I am concerned about the military reconstitution of ISIS. We actually have seen some very dangerous indicators that ISIS was able to exploit the instability in Iraqi Kurdistan, caused in part by the Kurdish referendum that occurred late last year and then the Iraqi government's response in the capture of Kirkuk City. We now have ISIS reconstituting in some of those disputed areas, and signs of the scale to which ISIS can now conduct military operations, which are including setting up fake checkpoints and imposing security on areas in Kirkuk and in Diyala, and actually expelling once again civilians from their homes and from villages in order to create space for ISIS to recruit, potentially to train and to reform as a military organization. It's not yet on the scale that fundamentally challenges Iraqi security, and I am hopeful that the U.S. will remain invested militarily in combating the ISIS resurgence, but it's definitely a threat, and there is a risk, I think, if further instability in the south continues to draw redeployments of Iraqi security forces away from previous ISIS-held areas and away from the borders with Iraqi Kurdistan. If those deployments south continue to happen, that there actually could be increased opportunity for ISIS to exploit in the near term.
And Ellen, what worries you as we go forward in Iraq? The intra-Shiite group rivalry, the resurgence of ISIS, how do you see it?
Well, I actually worry about the general socioeconomic conditions in the country. I think there really are some chronic structural problems that any Iraqi government will have to address. I think some Iraqis are worried about the impact of new American sanctions on Iran, on Iraq, that will create new economic pressures because Iraq is very dependent on Iran for imported goods. So there's going to be some financial secondary effects of renewed American sanctions against Iran. And I do worry about an erosion of enthusiasm or support for democratic practice in general. We had earlier seen the Kurdish region as sort of the vanguard of democratic behavior and democratic values. And I think people are now seeing, sort of slipping backwards, that this is still essentially a very tribal, paternalistic political culture. They don't really want challengers. They don't want fresh ideas and parties that represent the interests of young people. So I worry, as in Syria, of the outmigration of the educated people who are just a little bit giving up. So I see some long-term challenges, whether the coalition in Baghdad is led by Mr. Ameri or Mr. Abadi. I think either way, there are some long-term challenges for the country.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Jennifer Caffarella, she's Director of Intelligence Planning at the Institute for the Study of War, and Ellen Lapson, from whom you just heard. She's Professor and Director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University. We're examining the state of play in Iraq and soon in Syria. Now here's a shout-out to Mohamedou Saidou Treka from Messager Cameroon. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Turning back to you, Jennifer, and let's now move on to Syria. So let me go right to what you think the state of play is in Syria, whether regarding Bashar al-Assad's dominance or the resurgence of ISIS attacks. How do you see it?
Absolutely. I think what we're witnessing now is another phase change in this war. inside of Syria, which began, of course, as a initially peaceful uprising against the repressive regime of Bashar al-Assad, and then increasingly militarized as he used force against the protesters. The phase that is now concluding is essentially that original rebellion. What Bashar al-Assad has done with Russian and Iranian support is defeat the last remaining stronghold of moderate rebel groups that were independent, that challenged Assad, but were willing to come to the negotiating table. So Bashar al-Assad's advance south to the original birthplace of the rebellion in Deraa and his military victories there in recent weeks essentially ends that phase of the Syrian war. Now, there are still some Turkish-backed rebel groups in the north that are remnants of these original Free Syrian Army affiliates, but a bit of a different story there. That's more of a state proxy than it is an independent rebel group. So the unfortunate reality is Assad's gains and his defeat of the rebellion will not actually produce stability or peace inside of Syria. And the surge in ISIS activity that we've seen in the southwest is indicative, I think, of the future phase of the war, where groups like ISIS, but also al-Qaeda, retain military strength and intent to continue to fight, in part because Bashar al-Assad did not prioritize defeating the jihadists, precisely because he wanted to be able to hold the West hostage to his own survival by holding the threat of future jihadist attacks over the United States and Europe.
To you, Ellen Leibson, for your take on the state of play in Syria, do you see it similarly as Jennifer, sort of the end of one phase of that original rebellion, unfortunately, symbolically reflected by the evacuation of the White Helmets, this wonderful civil defense group that ran out to defend civilians when Bashar al-Assad attacked by air and other means? How do you see the situation?
Look, I think if the fighting stops now, on the one hand, the rest of the world will maybe have an initial reaction of, oh, good, at least the fighting has stopped, but at what cost? And it really is quite devastating to think of the destruction that's been done to the country in general, but also to the people who were in this fight. So I'm perhaps more interested in the broad geopolitics of Syria. And I think that Syria has become this platform to think about all the changing relationships in the region. So, you know, as in Iraq, we talked about a competition between U.S. and Iran. In the case of Syria, it's the U.S.-Russia relationship, and with Iran as the very fascinating little piece of the triangle, and not to mention Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey. But if we just go to the core of how do you get a diplomatic process started again, the Russians have the stronger hand right now. And I worry that the United States is acquiescing too much to accommodating a solution that would be more on Russia's terms than on what had been American policy in the past.
In that vein, Jennifer, some U.S. officials think that Russia has some kind of influence over Iran and that somehow Russia could rein in Iran, because we know Israel on the border will not tolerate an Iranian presence. And yet we also know that Bashar al-Assad wouldn't exist if it weren't for Iran. So there's a bit of a paradox there. I mean, does Russia, and do you think it has the political will to have any influence over Iran's role in Syria?
I would say briefly that the theory that the Russians can or would compel an Iranian withdrawal from Syria has yet to be supported by fact. The Russians have taken no action to compel the Iranians to withdraw. They do not have the forces in Syria that would be necessary to force Iran to do really anything. And the Russians are also dependent on Iran, not only for the survival of the Assad regime, because it's Iranian-provided ground forces that are keeping Assad in power, but the Russians are also therefore dependent on the Iranians in some ways to be able to hold on to the new air base and naval base that the Russians have established on the Syrian coast and intend to use moving forward to be able to project military power in the wider Middle East and Mediterranean region. So the Russians have neither the interest nor the capability actually to do what would be necessary to accomplish U.S. interests against Iran.
Would you agree, Ellen?
Well, I would agree that Russia cannot deliver on the maximalist expectation that the U.S. has, that Iran would somehow be kicked out of Syria entirely. I do think the Russians are deeply engaged in a give and take with Israel, Iran, and other countries on maybe finding some gray areas that would at least partially satisfy Israel and the United States. We have to bear in mind that Israel and Russia Russia also have a very good relationship right now, and that Israeli interests in pushing the Iranians back from their border, I think, is an achievable goal, even if the U.S. position, total withdrawal of Iran from Syria, is unachievable. I also think that, as you said, Jennifer, that in the end, whether Iran stays or goes is kind of a bilateral relationship between Iran and Syria, and the Russians have limited leverage. I don't think they have zero leverage, but I don't think they can just, you know, snap their fingers and make it happen. So the Russians are a player right now, even if they are not controlling everything that's going on the ground.
So back to you, Jennifer, to look at the U.S. role in the Northeast. The United States still has troops there, is that correct, who are primarily there to combat remnants of IS, the Islamic State?
Correct.
And do you see, notwithstanding statements by President Donald Trump that he would like to remove these troops, do you see that happening in the near future?
I do think it is possible we will see an American withdrawal from Syria in the near term, although I certainly hope that that does not occur.
Why not?
There are a few driving factors, I think. The first is that the U.S. local partner, the Syrian Democratic Forces, is actually engaged in a series of negotiations with the Assad regime for a potential deal for the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces, to become part of the reconstituting Syrian regime in a way that could actually lead the SDF to thank the United States for our help but discontinue that relationship.
And the SDF is a Kurdish group, is that correct?
It is a Kurdish-led group, yeah, with some significant Arab components in terms of fighting forces.
And how do you see it, Ellen, the calls by some U.S. officials, particularly President Trump, that, well, maybe it's time for the United States to remove its troops from Syria?
Well, I worry that we've already made a promise to the Russians that we won't support the opposition anymore. And there's some reporting that American diplomats tell these groups that they've been working with for a very long time, sorry, we're not going to be able to help you anymore. And so that would, again, be an example of a tactical way in which we're acquiescing to a Russian-led diplomatic process. But, you know, not unlike Iraq, I think from President Trump's perspective, can't we wrap this up? We had a mission. We did a good job. It's time to go home. So I don't think he personally favors a continued American military presence in the region. But I think both American diplomats and military officials would try to persuade him that some residual force is the right thing to do.
And Jennifer, what if there is not a residual force? And what are the implications of this continued disengagement of the United States from the Middle East, particularly Syria and Iraq? How do you see the geopolitical implications?
An American withdrawal from Syria would cede additional opportunity and terrain to both the Iranians and ISIS, and could actually lead to further destabilization inside of Syria as various groups, to include the regime, ISIS, and the Turks, compete over what is now U.S.-held terrain in cooperation with that local partner. We already do have the signs of ISIS resurgence in areas we recaptured, to include Raqqa City, where ISIS has already begun to claim to conduct explosive operations. So definitely not secure in the areas that we have recaptured, and withdrawing even further, reducing our footprint, even short of a full withdrawal, would cede additional opportunity to ISIS. The Iranians and the regime are also reaching out to local tribes and elements in U.S.-held areas in an attempt to undermine the SDF, even as they are negotiating with it, in order to prepare for the possibility that the U.S. stays but doesn't have the will or the capability to defend these areas against a future regime attack. So definitely multiple reasons why continued American engagement and will is necessary in this theater.
Ellen, how do you see the implications of continued U.S. disengagement from Syria in particular?
Well, I think the one factor we should add is the uptick in the aggressiveness and harshness of American statements about Iran. So whether we are entering a very different phase of U.S. policy towards Iran, in which Syria would be one of the venues in which that policy plays out, then I think we could argue that an American presence in Syria is part of that strategy.
We'll certainly have to follow up on both Iraq and Syria in the coming weeks. I'm afraid that's all the time we have, however, on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Jennifer Cuffarella. She's Director of Intelligence Planning at the Institute for the Study of War, and Ellen Lapson, Professor and Director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University. Ladies, thank you so much for your terrific insights.
Thanks, Carol.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Our engineer was Joe Gill, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.